My name is Claire. I'm 25 years old. The date is February 17th, 2024. I'm in the Virginia Tech Richmond Center, and I'm here with Donna, my one small step conversation partner.
My name is Donna, and I am 65 years old. The date is February 17th, 2024, and I am in the Virginia Tech Richmond Center. And I'm here with Claire, my one small step conversation partner.
Okay, this is Donna's bio. I am a 65-year-old retired female who has lived in Maryland, Indiana, and Virginia. I come from a large family with deep roots in rural Appalachia. Neither of my parents graduated from high school. In contrast, I became an educator working in higher education and state government. Inclusion and equity are very important to me, and I do what I can to support positive change in this direction. I am married and have two grown children. The youngest is a transgendered.
I'm going to read Claire's bio. Hi, I'm a 25-year-old and grew up and live in Central Virginia. I enjoy spending time with my friends, seeking out beautiful views, and all things podcasts, TV shows, and crafts. I'm surrounded by mainly progressive people in my social circles. And through my job as a facilitator, I have been exposed to more beliefs than I could ever have imagined. I care a lot about issues of justice, particularly surrounding bodily autonomy. Kindness and introspection are important to me.
All right. So, Donna, why did you want to participate in One Small Step?
My first reaction on hearing about the program was, I really like the idea of this program. I feel like it's something that we need. We need to be able to take steps necessary to address such political polarization. Mm-hmm. And to make it even a more personal answer, I have a very large extended family with incredibly different points of view, tend to be very argumentative, combative, and I struggle all the time with being different in my thinking and finding ways to connect. So I was hoping that this program might help in terms of the greater good, but also help me boots on the ground to connect with people that I love and care about who think differently than I do.
Yeah.
How about you?
That's
what were your reasons for wanting to participate?
When I introduce this to people, when I facilitate them, I talk about practice and how this is an opportunity that's out of a lot of folks' comfort zones, not something that everybody gets to do every day because it's not normalized in our particular culture, like U.S. culture, to speak across difference and to intentionally do so and speak across difference in a way that you have the like tacit message that it's going to be okay, whether you're with someone you know already, you still love each other, it's civil, you know, whatever that means. I like the idea that this is a good opportunity to try it out. Try it out with a stranger, which can be somebody, experience which is like easier in a lot of ways than somebody like family or a friend. For the greater good, I feel so steeped in this program. Mm-hmm. I live one small, like, I try to, like, there are, especially some of the conversation agreements that we read before we started, I try to live by them. Mm-hmm. Hmm. I don't think I believed in this as much as I do now when I started this job. Because sitting there and listening to as many perspectives as I have has changed me and allowed me to evaluate myself and hear from perspectives that I don't hear very often. You know, I do value introspection, and I think this is a great way to introspect and learn from somebody. Yeah.
You used a word that I am, that really, really sticks with me. And you said that this, there's an intentionality to this. Mm-hmm. And I already know what my big takeaway is from doing this is with respect to talking with family members that I just, as I described my challenge sometimes, mm-hmm. is oftentimes the conversations are not necessarily intentional. They're happenstance.
Yeah, you find yourself there.
Exactly. So maybe that could be my approach is to say, can we have an intentional conversation mm-hmm. with goals, as we've talked about, as they have been outlined here with the one-step program? That could be an approach.
Yeah.
I like it.
I took some classes in college that revolved around this word called peace building. And
what is it again?
Peace building.
Peace.
And it has the definition's like in the term. Like you're building peace, and it's in your personal relationships, and it's, you know, the circles get larger. And something that my professor said was that peace builders love conflict. They fall in love with conflict. And that is not the norm in my family. Like, I hear that your family leans in. My family leans way out, yeah. way out. I mean, there's direct communication. It's because, like, conflict's really hard. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But I have tried to become more friends with conflict and tried to improve. Yeah. I want to practice. Yeah, I want to be intentional and practice.
Have you ever heard the expression, go toward it?
Yes.
Because you have options.
Yeah.
You can back away, stand still, or go toward it.
Yeah.
And you probably already have sense with me. I'm a go toward it person. It's risky.
I want to be that.
Doesn't always work. Mm-hmm. But I have learned so much, mm-hmm. and I'm addicted to doing it in a way.
Anyway, what's the first thing you think of when you think of a time you went toward it? Or when did
honestly,
you become addicted?
The first thing that popped in my head, as you read in my bio, first generation high school graduate, big family, all the stereotypes apply. I was a strong student in school, and I had the opportunity to go to college. I happened to be raised in an environment where my peers were going to college, and academic success was normative mm-hmm. at school, not at home, but at school. And as I was approaching, 11th, 12th grade, I took something called the PACE exam, which is an exam to see if you qualify for a government kind of job. And I did well enough that I was offered a job at $9,000 a year.
Oh, hey.
This is 1970s. And I was talking to my dad about it, and he said, we should take it. Spur to hand. Do it. I said, yeah, but I'm really interested in college. And my father's comment was, you don't want to go to college. People go to college think they're better than everybody else. And I didn't buy that. And it was really, really, that's what comes to mind when I think about when did I go toward it mm-hmm. and do something other than, so I kind of challenged my father mm-hmm. at a young age. And that is not done at that time. Again, it was many years ago. Mm-hmm. And I'm really glad I did. It changed everything. Didn't help my relationship with Dad so much, but that's okay. Yeah. So that was one chance. Do you have an instance where you wanted to and didn't, or you would do differently?
I have an instance where I feel like I I've started an arc into like leaning towards it or going towards it.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was I've always wanted to have a plan in what I'm doing, and lean really into that. Because I don't want to feel like I'm floundering or not, I don't know what direction I'm going in. And for a while, my plan was to be a nurse and to become a nurse midwife eventually. Well, that was my real plan, to become a nurse midwife. I actually didn't want to be a nurse at all. Mm-hmm. But I ended up in nursing school twice because I didn't like the first nursing school I was in. And I did the first semester of that nursing school. It was really tough. The people were really nice. I was trying to look ahead, like I feel like a lot of nurses do, because it's not really easy for anybody to go through medical education of any kind. Nobody's like, I just love nursing. I'll just stay here the whole time. And like, I don't want to be a nurse. Except me. Still didn't want to be a nurse. But I went back from my second semester and my first day, and we started back like learning about the same body system. I really only ever cared about the reproductive system and having babies, and that was it. We started learning about the heart system and all this stuff again. I was like, more. Like, it was interesting. I was like, this again. And I was really having a hard time with my mental health. I drove myself home from my classes, and I had a really scary thought about that. That was a kind of a wake-up call. Mm-hmm. And I had put a lot of, I don't know, investment. Mm-hmm. And asked my parents to put a lot of investment in my nursing education. And I was started to tell them that I was going to be stopping. Mm-hmm. And I could tell that was not going to be their jam. Like, particularly my mom, she was not in love with that idea. I have always been a person who can't stay somewhere I'm not having a good time at. Sometimes I try to frame it as like, you know, being a quitter, not that bad. You know what you want. So it was a big decision to stop nursing and to lean into actually finding out what I wanted. I had gotten so far away from the obstetrical, gynecological stuff and gotten so embroiled in how miserable I thought nursing was, and it was lost on me as a dream. And I went to the general colleges, like, what's the word? Like, keeping students in school. Retention counselor. And I was like crying. And I don't know why this memory really sticks to me with me. I cried and I dropped one of my tissues, which was, in my opinion, pretty nasty. And that man picked it up and threw it away from me. And he was so kind, and just counseled me through this big change. I told him, I don't know what I want. I just can't do this anymore. And he picked these perfect classes for me to transition into, including like peace building and mediation facilitation and art classes again. I hadn't taken art classes in so long. And that definitely led to the job I have. Yeah. And ever since then, I've like called it my being brave or living big and failing big era.
Claire, too. I hear your story as you took care of yourself.
Yeah.
You know, that's the moral of the story I just heard, is you took care of yourself. You recognized what you needed.
Yeah.
So that's hard. To me, that's a Good job.
Thank you. I am trying to lean towards it, mm-hmm. go towards it more mm-hmm. now. It's hard not to replace.
And you're 25. Nurse, midwifery, there's time.
Yeah.
I followed my educational dream in my late 40s.
Tell me about it.
That's when I started my PhD program, mm-hmm. and it was my soul searching mm-hmm. thing. Actually, one of my objectives in deciding to go back to school, I was working in higher ed, and being raised in the environment that I was raised, I always had this feeling of I was never entitled. I'm not, it's what poverty does to people. It's one of the reasons that issues of equity and this really does inform a lot of my political beliefs. The harm that comes to people who are not given an opportunity. And I am so, so grateful that I was born in a place and a time that I was. I went to school. My undergraduate education would not have been possible were it not for the political policies that mm-hmm. came out of the civil rights movement in the 60s. I was able to go to school because there was federal financial aid. I qualified to the max. My parents had nothing. And I'm the second of six children. I recognized that the time was right, and it has transformed my life. And I have so many friends and family where they weren't afforded that. I feel a mm-hmm. huge responsibility to give back mm-hmm. As a result. I also carry somewhat of an imposter syndrome mm-hmm. because of that early imprinting of this is who you are. And cycles of cultural reproduction. My father saying to me, "No, it's not a good thing. You should, hard scrabble. You don't need to put on airs." Kind of attitude. Working in higher education, I moved from being a student in the kind of context that I just described, that is a public state university, which I think are incredibly critical social mm-hmm. institutions, to becoming an employee at the university and experiencing professional success just because of my, the work ethic and the sense of connection and commitment I had to the institution. I used to say, "Cut me and I bleed black and gold," because that's what the school colors were, because I was really into it. And it was my, it was a transformative experience for me. But I was still haunted by this feeling of being other, marginalized, mm-hmm. Not really belonging. And so I say when I went back to do my graduate work, decided to do a graduate program, it was somewhat an investment in my professional career, which frankly I had never even conceived of having a career. It was just get by, because I had been only around people who were making money to survive. It wasn't about career or profession. It was about how do you buy the groceries and put shoes on the kids' feet kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So my identity started to change through this experience of being in the academic setting for so long and feeling so safe and comfortable there because they took care of me in many ways. And I thought, I'll do the PhD. I'll do that. So I did it at the institution where I was working, and I didn't really know what it was I wanted to get out of it other than to maybe wrestle my demons.
Great.
I knew that I had never felt comfortable with my writing and my use of language, and I knew that I'd have to produce language in order to get through this experience. Mm-hmm. It took me 7 years, a long time. And I did wrestle the demons, and I can't even begin to tell you how much I learned through the experience. And what I did with the PhD evolved and changed significantly. People ask me, so what's your PhD in and what was it about? And I ended up writing about personal identity and how how people want to be the author of their own story and not have it written for them, which is what oppression does. It writes your life for you. So you can see how this all connects. Mm-hmm. And I say it's the best thing I ever did, and I wish the educational system would kind of flip things around and give people the opportunity to explore and to find and to go down rabbit holes. And that's what, because you're doing independent research when you're in a doctoral program, that's what I did. And I would not have been able to do it if my husband weren't, I mean, I recognize the privilege that was involved in this. My husband was paying the bills through his academic career and so on. And I was able to spend the time and the energy, and I just threw myself heart and soul into it. And it was transformative. So it's not too late. go with it. And it's interesting to me that what I ended up writing about was autobiographical in many ways. Mm-hmm. It was, even though I was doing ethnographic life histories mm-hmm. for other people who were experiencing change. They were faculty at the university.
Oh, cool.
And they were artists, by the way. All these things connect. Faculty artists who were being pushed. The programs they were involved in were going to get cut because they're not professionally oriented. You can't go out and get a job if you've been making pottery. Do you know what I mean? That's where science, technology, engineering, mathematics, all the STEM programs were getting all the funding and so on. And this was pissing me off because no, this is not the only purpose of higher education. Mm-hmm. And I had lived it and I wanted to preserve it. And I went into that PhD program, wanted to save the world. And my big takeaway was I probably can't accept one step at a time, one conversation at a time, one life at a time. Mm-hmm. It was hard. I wanted to be a big changer. But anyway. So you know why One Small Step resonates with me, because that's how, to me, it's the Margaret Mead view of change.
When
grassroots efforts.
When I was a nursing student, I would get in trouble because I spent light trouble. I mean, I had very kind professors, but I spent too long doing the interview, get to know you intake with the patients and less about what's going on with your kidneys. And mm-hmm. I was too busy asking them questions like, if you could write the title of your current chapter in your life, what would be the title?
Interesting.
And I just, feel like I was gathering clues. So I feel like I want to ask you the same thing about your chapter right now. What would you title it? And also, have you ever considered, did you include your ethnography as part of your
PhD? Well, to do an ethnographic life histories, framework for that is you're making something with another person. Mm-hmm. You're co-constructing the narrative. So, every question I ask my research participants, I did with myself. So it is autoethnographic as it's a wonder. I would do this the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. That's kind of why I'm here too, to be honest. I fell in love with the methodology. Mm-hmm. I loved it. Mm-hmm. And to this day, I interviewed, I did life histories with 4 people. That was what my research was, 4 mm-hmm. ethnographic life histories, 420 some pages, a lot of content. But those 4 people will always be woven into the fabric of who I am.
Yeah.
Because of the time we spent together.
Yeah.
And didn't, you know, so I'm trying to remember your question now.
Current chapter.
Oh, yes. So my first interview question was them. So if your life were going to be a book, what would be the chapter titles?
There you go.
So I've had that question asked of myself by me before. And the chapter that I'm in right now is having a blast.
Awesome.
I am unconstrained by job. Mm-hmm. And if for some, and I've had to work my whole life. I started working when I was 12. Mm-hmm. And money has always been a struggle, at least until, up until I married up, so to speak, with my husband, which is why I feel such a responsibility. Now that I have the resources, I want to find ways of contributing. Mm-hmm. And I think the arts are a wonderful way of connecting with people. Mm-hmm. So I'm having a blast because I feel unconstrained, and I also am not encumbered by the voices that were taught to me. They're still there. There's the old expression, monkeys on your back. Mm-hmm. Well, the monkeys aren't on my back anymore. They may be riding alongside of me, ready to jump on them in a weak moment, mm-hmm. but they're not driving me anymore. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I actually love that metaphor.
Yeah.
Of the, we all have monkeys on our back. The goal is not to have them driving your bicycle.
Yeah. I really like
it
too.
Does that make sense?
Yes, it
does.
Yeah.
Because you can't erase them. They're there. Mm-hmm. And when you're tired or lonely or, your resources are low, that's when they jump right on there and
right.
start taking control.
I see you. Yeah.
Yeah. But they don't have to. So the monkeys aren't in control right now.
I love having a blast.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's great.
I see it in my art. I'm feeling very experimental. It's not about precision, exactitude. It's about, I can try this. I'm going to see where this takes me. Just give it a whirl. Say
What's
yes.
the latest thing
say
you
yes.
tried?
Say yes. Say yes. And if it doesn't work, it's only pigment on canvas.
So true. You can paint right over it. Mm-hmm. What was the latest thing you tried, like experimental?
Let's see. Well, I started doing pottery last summer. Mm-hmm. And I go into the studio and I say, I've never made a picture. All right, let's give it a go. Mm-hmm. And if it flops over and doesn't work, so what? I'll try it again. So little things like that. I'm trying to think of some other things. This is a big thing. I have two children. My youngest was born 1996, older than you, Claire. Maggie Owen Taylor. And Maggie was diagnosed with autism, high functioning autism, very, very smart, only challenges with sensory issues and communication, but no cognitive dysfunction. So for a long time, we thought, oh, this is a really gifted kid who's just a little quirky, until middle school, high school. And then we recognized, no, there's more going on here. Anxiety, depression, made a suicide gesture. Mm. And long and short of it, by the time Maggie went off to college, decided that there's some gender dysphoria, and that the issue wasn't feeling the female thing at all.
Cool.
And that's a hard thing for a parent. And I didn't see it coming. I was so focused on the autism and the other mental health issues.
Yeah.
I didn't see transgender as, or gender identity. That was not what was presenting as the challenge. So, as a parent, this was a hard thing because I realized it's not my agenda. And I think I'm answering your question about trying something different. Yeah, this was different for me.
Yeah.
Not totally unanticipated. Not like the media presentation of transgendered at all. Not the, oh, here's the 4-year-old little boy who wants to play with dolls and dress up like a girl. No.
Yeah,
speak none on of that. It. None of that. And I will say, so Owen transitioned, has had top surgery. That was 2 or 3 years ago. Made the very, very brave decision to do this, come out, and so on. His first year of college, which was, by the way, delayed because he was in a special program for young adults with learning differences and so on. So everything's a little bit delayed. So his decision to transition was after the age of 21. Parents have nothing to say about that. It's not, I shouldn't say nothing to say, but as an adult, it's his decision. You know, and I don't meet many people who have trans children. I feel lonely in that regard. Do you know? If I do, it's usually they've disowned their child. And this is not happening with me. Mm-hmm. This is still the same person to me. And I tell people, it's like, I know my sister's had plastic surgery, had her eyelids lifted and so on. Well, that's her altering her body for her purposes of identity. Mm-hmm. Well, that's what Owen has done as well.
Yeah, it's fair enough.
Is that fair? So anyway, so that's kind of a, I think that has been an experience where I have had to go for it. Do you know? Just
that's a lot of newness.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, and he's very happy.
I was wondering. How's he doing?
Yeah, full-time job, making a living, doing great, has a little trouble keeping his apartment clean, but other than that, to the point where, like, the maids quit because it's too dirty, they can't, you know, gonna have to pick up the place, so, but that is his autistic brain, is just never going to be the person to conceive of creating an organizational system in his apartment.
So. Must be cooler things to think about.
Yeah, ice hockey.
Yeah.
And other things. So, and he's a great person. Just a great guy. So
I want you to meet more parents of trans kids.
Yeah. Set me up.
I mean, there are a lot of people who participate in One Small Step with trans kids.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Cool.
That's right.
Well, just knowing that too. Helps.
Yeah.
Knowing that helps.
It's really true. And they have as many, you know, experiences as many different shades of experiences as you're saying, as yours is completely unique. Yeah.
I wish he was closer.
I was wondering, does he live close?
He doesn't like the heat here.
Oh, that's right. He lives in Rhode Island.
Yeah. Right. Likes and I get it, because, you know, moms have a tough gig sometimes because kids need space to try and fail. Mm-hmm. Try and, you know, so his autonomy is really important to him at this stage, which means I do without. But that's okay. I get it. That's all right. You know, that's okay.
I think my mom might be feeling that way right now, too.
Wow. So, and the, oh, how can I forget this? Massachusetts paid for his surgery. It's okay. One of the most progressive political states there can you can find, and they have programs to support the trans community all over the place. So that's how Owen was able to. And so Virginia is not going to be that place, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's
not going to be the same place.
Oh my, no. I was just at the other week at a book banning forum for, bless their hearts, like teachers and students, and it was protected by a police person outside, and so much passion from these teachers who I feel like they might have been, I mean, I don't know, but I feel like they're doing way more than they expected as teachers to have to do. So supportive of kids, and like, come to me. They were reading the laws out and talking about protests that they've been to, and when we have this kind of protest, what do you do? How do you talk to police or not talk to police? And then the kids that were there, they had just in the county I live in, I think recently banned 57 books, 67, something like that, all in a swoop. And some of them, the library didn't even have. The libraries in the county didn't even have the books. It was just books that they read about in like forums that were like, we should ban this book. And they were all the kinds of subjects you would expect. There was a retired librarian there that was like, this is the process it should have gone through. She was like, I'm the librarian and I know the rules, and they broke the rules. I was like, I'm glad you exist. But yeah. Lots of parents, lots of kids who spoke from their hearts. Nobody had a piece of paper with them of talking points. It gave me a lot of hope. But also, it was so intense. It was so intense. It's intense to be a kid in Virginia.
Yes.
And
yes.
Especially in the outer counties.
Scary in a way for me.
How did you approach book reading with your kids?
I read them everything, and nothing was off limits at all. Same with film, movie, TVs. To me, these were all teachable moments.
Yeah, my dad will grumble, well, I'll let you read whatever you wanted. You know, what do you mean? Like, we trust you to judge for yourself. It's remarkable.
Yeah.
Idea that you can't trust your kid.
Right.
And there's a lot of disrespecting a kid's privacy there too. That really, really grinds my gears.
Yeah. I trusted my kids. I still do. They know it. They've always known it. I can remember, Caitlin is my daughter, oldest, from my first marriage. She's 9 years older than Owen. And by the way, Maggie Owen Taylor just goes by Owen now. So good that we gave Owen a name.
That's a good name.
I could use. Yeah. Caitlin, she was reading, it was a Holocaust novel. I'm totally blanking on what it's called. We, is that it? And it was upsetting to her. And we talked, so she's like, this book is just, it's excruciating. This was middle school. And we heard her, we listened and said, I could see she knew when to stop, when to pick it up again, process it in her own way with us, seeking out comfort and safety as she needed it. And I just learned that I can trust this kid to do that. When Owen was younger, by the way, with Owen, when we refer to Owen in the Maggie era, it's when Owen was Maggie, or we say Maggie, but anything that's current, we say Owen.
Gotcha.
Because that's the truth. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so if I'm reflecting, it's Maggie. So when Maggie was in fifth grade and they read Old Yeller, or started, I don't know if you guys know that book, but young boy has to shoot the dog who's got rabies. Maggie kindly put the book down and said, I cannot read this. I couldn't read Shiloh, the book about the dog. Yeah, do you know Shiloh, the beagle that gets kicked by the nasty old guy up in the hill? Just couldn't take it. And so again, I trust my kids. They know. They know what, when to say no. Mm-hmm. That's enough. So, oh my gosh. So what do we want to make sure we talk about before we run out of time? I know. I have a question.
Yes,
for
please.
You. In your bio, there's so much here. Issues of justice. Mm. Bodily autonomy. Mm-hmm. Tell me more, because... Yeah, that resonates with me.
I think it's when I first started caring a lot about midwife obstetrical stuff. And I left the first college that I went to, Clark, came home, my parents were like, so what are you going to do now? Mm-hmm. I was like, okay, I'll be a midwife. I watched Call the Midwife, and I loved all the medical school shows, all the medical shows. And I was like, this would be rad. Mm-hmm. And I always drew, like, pictures of pregnant people when I was a kid, and loved it when my teachers got pregnant in school. But, yeah, I messaged all the midwives in my town, in Charlottesville at the time. I was like, I want to be a midwife. What do I do? Like, how... And it was like through their contact forms. Only one responded. And she was like, you should do a doula training. Mm-hmm. So you know if you want to do this. Because it's for real. And I was like, what is a doula? First, what is a doula? And I learned that it was like an emotional support partner. It's sort of physical, but like mostly like process with kind of a birth facilitator, which is funny because I just call everything else like doulas now. Like one small step doula. People have heard me say that before, but yeah, I took the doula training and it really solidified my feelings that people should have the birth pregnancy experience that they should want. That's what I learned. Full stop. When, where, how, like every detail of that. I want them to be as involved as they possibly can. I want it in their hands and to feel like they were in control of their bodies. And I learned a lot then about, because at the same time I was learning about my body and how people saw my body different because I live in a larger body, I thought a lot about how medical people treat my body and treat pregnant bodies, and that they're too much. It's too much. I don't like it. So yeah, I became a doula through that training. I was like, all doulas and midwives must be like pro-choice, not anti-abortion. Like, of course they are. Come on. We all took this same training. I was wrong. There are plenty.
How far back do you remember wanting to be involved with delivering babies and doula? Are you an older sibling?
I am an older sibling. I was fascinated by my mom being pregnant, and I remember like little friends' moms being pregnant, and I have a memory of her letting all the kids like come and touch her belly, but I was too scared. But yeah, bodily autonomy, it's about abortion for me, but it's become about way more than that too. And what you do with your body is your choice, and how you advocate for your body is really important to me, and it's in medical settings. I want people to feel empowered to feel on equal footing with their doctors and mm-hmm. and such, and not feel on a hierarchy and workers, like in solidarity with other workers, mm-hmm. like not feel controlled by their bosses because you have rights. And even like I had a lot of trouble. Well, no, I don't know if I did in that at the time, because I was terrified during COVID. And I was like, please, everybody get the vaccine, because I'm so scared. And I really don't want my parents to get this. Mm-hmm. My dad's immunocompromised, and I really don't want him to get COVID. Mm-hmm. And so, and then in hindsight, and then also hearing people speak about their perspectives of not being pro-vaccine or pro-COVID vaccine, or however their journeys went through that, it has made me think a little more. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I think, like, well, I wish that we were just more supportive of each other in community and had the value and understanding, like educational understanding of why we would get that, rather than having to mandate it, you know, on a whole population of people. Wow. And that complicated, I guess, because I do believe in bodily autonomy, I feel like more than I believe in. I don't know.
Yeah, bodily autonomy, however, be informed about how your bodily autonomy affects your community.
Oh, big time.
Yeah. Interesting. I get what you're saying, you know? Big word.
Donna, is there anything that you want to make sure we touched on?
Yeah.
Let me think that through. I've covered a lot, at least.
I was curious about anything that Appalachian roots.
I'm an avid genealogist, by the way, so I really, really connect with the family roots kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And it's because I'm not going to have grand. I think part of the reason is, well, first of all, I've always been the family historian, the researcher in me. It's like, dig, find, you know. I'm not going to have grandchildren. So I'm writing an I'm writing a family history of my Appalachian roots. And the thing that propels me is the women of Appalachia. First of all, people who were illiterate. There are no documents. There aren't even tax records because they're living more or less off the grid, as we would say today. And these are lives that matter.
Extremely.
And my paternal grandmother was born June 1st, 1900. She married the man living next door whose wife had just died. He had 10 children. And so she was 16. He was 47. She then had 10 children. So he fathered 20 children. My father's the 19th of the 20.
Wow.
When I think about my grandmother's life, I can't find any evidence that she was ever able to make a life choice of her own.
How does that make you feel?
It makes me so sorry that I didn't talk more with her. I was young when she died. But just to listen, to ask her, tell me about your life, for her to be heard. It makes me so sad to think that she wasn't afforded the basic respect. She struggled her entire life. It makes me feel guilty that I don't struggle as much. I wish that her value was known to her. And that's true with not just my paternal grandmother, but it's everyone who was involved in subsistence living. My mother moved 13 times in 1 year when she was 9. They were itinerant farm workers. This is going to sound really bizarre at what level. But the only thing of value that they had was their whiteness. Mm. You know, if they had been black, they would have been slaves, essentially, itinerant farm workers, you know. But that whiteness was, in fact, cultural capital at one level. Mm-hmm. But that was about it. You know, they were religiously ostracized. They were Rolling Stones, family of 11. So I the Appalachian roots, it gives me so many things to think about. It's a perspective mm-hmm. that fuels me in many ways. And I'm really, really interested in making sure that lives are not for naught. You know, I would like to be able to the best of my ability, tell stories that otherwise might not be construed as in any way important or valuable.
Yeah. I can see that.
Yeah.
One follow-up question. Mm-hmm. Do you think that your grandmother's life influences your relationship with your son and maybe being more accepting?
Absolutely. Put it that way, I say yes. Because when I look at my son, again, take gender out of the question. That's not about that. This is the person that I've known, you know, forever and ever and ever. And his journey is...
Yeah, you made him.
Yeah, and we've shared so much. And I'm troubled by the stereotypes and the dismissive, the lack of understanding, I should say. I'm trying not to be too slanted in my language here, but anybody who really listened to Owen's story wouldn't be politically in the position of being anti-trans, you know, all this. I mean, these are not sexual deviants. And I have found in my experience that, you know, knowing someone and being open to their experience can change or can complicate and challenge what you might take as a political point of view, that goes unexamined, because one life can change your thinking mm-hmm. and how that thinking is shaping your political point of view. Okay. So, I have a sister who's gay. She'd been married for 35 years, and it's a wonderful, loving relationship. And for people who don't respect that, I wish they only knew my sister Sandy and her partner Wanda, and could see what beautiful lives they have. You know, I worry about those universal labels that just obscure the complexity of everyone's life and the meaning that's embedded there. So that's how I would answer that question, Justin. It was, every life is precious and valuable. It would make me a horrible policymaker because policies are difficult to individualize. But I have decided in my life, if I'm going to err, I'm going to err on the side of the individual and their importance.
Hear, hear.
So hear, hear. Thank you for asking that question. That was helpful.
All right.
So what's something you guys are going to take with you?
That intentionality thing that I mentioned mm-hmm. at the top when you mm-hmm. said, you know, just have these conversations, be intentional. I like that.
I think what you said about stepping forward, life oscillates and then nothing's linear. So I have to give myself some grace for that. I feel like I've released the gas a little bit. Mm-hmm. But it is still a value of mine that mm-hmm. I want to live into. And you're inspiring me. And I loved your PhD project, and I could see myself doing something like that. I just have found everything so inspiring that you share with
me. It didn't do a damn thing for me in terms of income and professional life.
But yeah, I see.
I am different, and I would.
Yeah.
It was fabulous.
Yeah, I see that coming for
me. Something I take away from getting to know you, Claire, I feel comfort in knowing a 25-year-old is doing all kinds of wonderful things, is open to learning, you know, facing challenges and so on, and just, and you're, you know, you're going to meetings with teachers about book banning. You want to make a difference, and that gives me hope. Mm-hmm. Hope. All we can do is try.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that I take away. And I feel supported by both of you in having a trans child. When you said you want me to know other trans parents, that made me feel really loved and cared for. Thank you.
Yeah. You should feel that way.
You
are.
It's lonely sometimes, and I really appreciate that. Mm-hmm. So,
thank you, Donna.
I don't want to stop.
Yeah, I mean, you can stop the recording, but we don't have to stop.
Yeah. So this is great.